The headlines Iran says it has received the first data from remote sensing Hayom satellite hours after it was launched into space aboard a Russian Soyuz rocket. The Pentagon confirms for the first time that it's supplying Ukraine with anti-radar missiles to use against Russia in the war. And also coming up, China warns separatist forces in Taiwan not to cross its red lines as both sides engage in military drills of their own around the Taiwan Strait. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the Iranian Ministry of Information and Communication says it has received the first data from the Hayom satellite hours after it was launched into space from a base in Kazakhstan. The ministry says the data was received at the Iranian Space Agency's Mohdasht base. Hayom, aboard a Russian Soyuz rocket, was blasted off from Baikonur Cosmodrome on Tuesday. This is a remote sensing satellite that will send high-quality pictures four times a day for use in environmental and agricultural researches and monitoring of water resources. The head of the Iranian Space Agency says the satellite is capable of capturing space images with a resolution accuracy of 1 meter. President Ibrahim Raisi has hailed the successful launch of the satellite, calling it a moment of pride. Raisi says Iran will unveil more achievements in the aerospace field, which will be helpful for various areas such as the environment. A Palestinian man has died of wounds he sustained during Israeli strikes on the besieged Gaza Strip over the weekend. The man was critically injured after Israeli missiles hit a residential neighborhood in the city of Beit Hanun. His death brings to 47 the number of Gazans killed during the three-day Israeli onslaught on the besieged territory. Four women and 16 children are among the dead, while some 360 people were wounded. In response to Israel's attacks, the Islamic Jihad resistance movement fired hundreds of rockets at Israeli cities, including Tel Aviv, Sderot, and Ashkelon. An Egypt-brokered truce ended the latest bout of Israeli strikes on Gaza. Four Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank. Israeli military killed three Palestinians, including a fighter and a member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Ibrahim Al-Nablusi, in Nablus. A fourth Palestinian was killed during a protest in Al-Khalil. We have more in this report.
Israeli forces have assassinated Ibrahim Al-Nablusi, a resistance fighter and commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Israeli troops raided Nablus early Tuesday and surrounded a building in the old city where Al-Nablusi had barricaded himself in. A gunfight lasted for several hours with Israeli forces even firing anti-tank missiles at the building. 32-year-old Islam Sabouh and 16-year-old teen Hossein Jamal Taha were also killed in the raid. At least 60 Palestinians were wounded, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry.
We have not witnessed such an aggressive raid to Nablus in years. The aim was to assassinate Al-Nablusi and any other Palestinian who was assisting him. He refused to surrender and clashed with the soldiers for hours and was finally martyred.
As the raid started, we rushed to the old town, but the soldiers had blocked the neighborhood. They opened fire at us. We tried to evacuate the wounded, including a woman, but they continued shooting at us. Dozens were wounded as a result.
Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid has reacted to Nablus operation, saying that the killing of whom he described as terrorist Ibrahim Nablusi was another step in Israel's uncompromising fight against terrorism.
This cell has been warring Israeli military. They carried out a number of shooting against Israeli soldiers and settlers. That is why the Israeli military wanted to strike them and kill one of its leaders.
A number of West Bank cities, including Ramallah and Al-Khalil, observed commercial strikes as part of a period of mourning and in protest at the killings in Nablus. The regime forces clashed with the protesters in Al-Khalil and shot dead at least one Palestinian.
It has become clear that Israel is targeting any Palestinian who is honored as a real fighter. The regime might succeed in assassinating those fighters like Ibrahim Nablusi, but they would even be remembered as heroes and icons who devoted their lives to fighting Israeli soldiers. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Well, the U.S. says it has sent anti-radar missiles to Ukraine to help it target Russia's radar systems in the ongoing war between the two neighbors. The Pentagon says the missiles are the high-speed anti-radiation missile, or HARM, and were included in the $1 billion in additional military aid package for Kyiv. There is no mention of the exact number, but it's the first time the Defense Department has revealed sending the previously undisclosed missile to Ukraine. Ukrainian authorities have not publicly acknowledged receiving or using HARMs, but in recent days, some reports have shown the remains of what appeared to be the fin of a HARM missile that targeted a Russian position in Ukraine. The U.S. has sent $9.8 million in military aid to Kyiv since the launch of Russia's military offensive there in February.
The war in Ukraine has caused enormous distress to the civilian population in the war-stricken areas. Ukraine and Russia have accused each other of endangering the lives of civilians. A report by Amnesty International, which is a Western rights group and is biased towards Western-style liberal democracies, has now accused Ukraine of flouting international law by exposing civilians to Russian fire. The report accuses the Ukrainian military of having established its bases in schools and hospitals. It says the Ukrainian military has launched counterattacks from heavily populated areas.
So the West is actively shaping the narrative, and it's also realizing that the narrative that the West has been provoking through Ukraine, that Ukraine has been regurgitating, is becoming increasingly seen as absolutely false. There's no facts or truth behind any of the words or the ideas or the images that the U.S. narrative has been trying to communicate. Specifically, the Russians are not losing, the Russians are not retreating.
As it was expected, the report angered Ukrainian officials. In reaction to Kyiv's objection, Amnesty has issued a statement expressing its regret for the, quote, distress and anger that the report has caused amongst Ukrainian officials. Amnesty has, however, said that it stands by its findings. It has noted that the evidence it has documented does not justify, quote, Russia's violations. The blame game comes amid intensified efforts by the United States to keep the war going in East Ukraine.
Well, I think the grotesque blundering and failure of the United States in Ukraine has been ongoing for a long, long time, of course. Ever since 2009 to 2019, the United States has been involved with funding illegal global viral biological chemical labs. It's been involved with training Ukrainian soldiers. Inspiring them to commit acts of genocide. The U.S. has been behind all of the Ukrainian madness for a long time.
The U.S. has been the largest contributor of weapons to Ukraine by far. Ironically, other NATO members who have supplied Ukraine with weapons like Germany had actually purchased their weapons from American arms manufacturers. And where those unaccounted weapons end up, according to Interpol, many weapons will end up on the black market and in the hands of criminals.
The Biden administration has just announced a $1 billion arms and weapons package for Ukraine. That's the largest military installment to Ukraine since the war began in February. The upcoming military package is the 18th such tranche and brings U.S. commitment to about $9.8 billion. The package consists of HIMARS systems, 75,000 rounds of 155mm artillery ammunition, mortar systems, and 20,000 rounds and mortar ammunition, as well as munitions for National Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile Systems.
Most of these weapon systems are actively being manned and fired, and targeting is being done by U.S. Military and CIA forces, as well as British. But the Ukrainians are doing very, very little, except they're dying. So all of the weapons that the West has sent in there, I think, was initially done recklessly without any real consideration of what the military requirements are for training.
The HIMARS are designed to shoot a variety of missiles and have sat high on Ukrainian wish lists. The supply of arms and weapons to Ukraine comes amid reports that the weapons sent to Ukraine do not make it to the front lines. There are reports that only 30% of weapons sent to Ukraine actually end up in the hands of Ukrainians. Reports say the rest go missing.
And now, I think the irony is all of these weapons are simply being sold on the black market by various parties because they're unmanageable. Now, what you will see most likely as well are these weapon systems emerging in small conflicts in Europe, which could be all sorts of domestic insurrections. You could have criminal gangs using a lot of these weapons. So the real loser of all of these Western weapons from the United States that have been sent in is going to be Europe.
Just recently, U.S. news channel CBS was forced to partially retract a documentary in which it said that shipments of weapons to Ukraine from the U.S. had been going missing. The documentary had apparently angered officials in Ukraine. It now appears that warlords in Washington are committing the same mistake they did in Afghanistan and Syria.
I like the structural path we're on here. As long as we help Ukraine with the weapons they need and the economic support, they will fight to the last person.
The Washington regime has poured so much weapons and ammunition in those regions that wars will likely continue for years. Now Ukraine appears to be the next victim of Washington's warmongering machinery.
China pledges zero tolerance for, quote, separatist activities in Taiwan and warns that it will take the island by force if necessary. China's Taiwan Affairs Office has issued a white paper laying out economic and military measures with regards to the self-ruled island. That says both sides engage in military drills and shows of strength. Footages show Chinese jets flying while Navy ships patrolling around the island and the strategic Taiwan Strait. The Chinese Army, however, says the drill is focused on blockades and resupply logistics to refine joint containment and control capabilities. China has carried out a set of naval and air drills near Taiwan since last week. Maneuvers followed a controversial visit by the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island. Taiwan has also mobilized its air and land patrols and deployed land-based missile systems. China claims Taiwan as its own territory and has repeatedly warned against the island's growing nexus with the United States. A veteran Syrian politician has blasted the U.S. for stealing the country's natural resources.
The United States is currently occupying Syrian territories and plundering Syria's grain and oil resources. These actions of the United States are very shameful. Hence, we never trust anything the United States says because what they say is seriously contrary to what they do.
Chabon also condemned Washington's illegal military presence in Syria. She made the remarks as the latest data released by the Syrian Ministry of Oil and Mineral Resources show the U.S. has been plundering most of the oil produced in the country. The ministry says U.S. and militant groups it supports pillaged over 80% of daily oil production in the first half of 2022. Damascus considers U.S. presence as an outright violation of its sovereignty. It has repeatedly deplored Washington for supporting armed groups and stealing natural resources. A U.S. federal court has found a former Twitter manager guilty of spying for Saudi Arabia's royal family. Ahmad Abu Amo was convicted on six criminal charges, including fraud, money laundering, and conspiracy. He was hired by a close advisor to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for gaining access to personal information of Saudi dissidents. Prosecutors said that Abu Amo, dual U.S.-Lebanese citizen, received at least $300,000 for sharing private information of Twitter users. Also, Ali Al-Zabara, a colleague of Abu Amo, was accused of accessing Twitter accounts on behalf of Saudi Arabia. He left the U.S. before being charged. Riyadh was accused of spying on the U.S. for the first time with the arrest and indictment of Abu Amo in late 2019. Colombia and Venezuela say they are moving towards restoring bilateral relations just days after new Colombian president Gustavo Petro took the oath of office. Petro says the two neighbors are now working on the normalization process, which also involves border reopening. During the campaign trail, the leftist leader repeatedly pledged to resume ties with Venezuela. Meanwhile, Venezuela's defense minister Vladimir Padrino Lopez said Caracas plans to reestablish military ties with Bogota. Last month, the foreign ministers of the two countries met in a Venezuelan border city where they expressed desires to reinstate ties at the ambassadorial level. Relations between the two South American neighbors were broken in 2019 after then-Colombian President Ivan Duque refused to recognize the re-election of his Venezuelan counterpart Nicolas Maduro. Tens of thousands of Shia Muslims took to the streets in Indian-administered Kashmir to mark the martyrdom anniversary of Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein. Our correspondent has a report on that.
Streets in parts of Muslim-majority Kashmir flooded with mourners clad in black, waving flags and banners with messages from the battlefield of Karbala written over them. Young and old, men and women participated in the mourning ceremonies on the day of Ashura. Ashura marks the day when Imam Hussein and his companions were martyred by forces of tyrant Yazid in Karbala. To carry forward Imam Hussein's legacy, centuries after the Battle of Karbala, Imam Hussein's martyrdom is commemorated across the globe.
These processions during the month of Muharram have a message. First, to keep the younger generations posted, and second, to not let the world forget how good one over the evil.
Reciting elegies, chanting pro-Islamic slogans, and the resonating sound of chest beating, every eye is moist in memory of the battle for humanity.
We have been entrusted with a mission, and it becomes our responsibility to carry the lessons and teachings forward so that our upcoming generations know their legacy well.
Each year during the holy month of Muharram, religious organizations and groups organize seminars, processions and lectures. Here in Kashmir, authorities have demarcated the routes for Muharram processions, mostly in Shia-dominated areas. Following a three-decade-old ban imposed on Muharram processions through traditional routes, authorities in sensitive Kashmir believe these emotional mourning processions may turn into a law and order problem, thus arrangements are made in confined areas.
For Muslims, the event of Karbala marks a new beginning of resilience. The processions held year after year reinforce integrity towards the mission of truth, justice and peace initiated by Imam Hussein some 1400 years ago on the battlefield of Karbala. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The leader's viewpoint on Imam Hussein's revolution and Ashura. On the day of Karbala, Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam and his companions were martyred in an abandoned desert where there was not any friend and where there were many enemies. On that day, his family members were taken captive, and that was over. Today, this event, which should normally have been destroyed and consigned to oblivion after 10-15 days, is still prominent. Even after the passage of many centuries, the name of Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam is shining like the sun, and it is enlightening hearts and offering guidance not only among millions of Shias and other Muslims in different Islamic countries, but also among non-Muslims.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
On the day of Ashura, Zainab al-Kubra salamullah alayha watched many of her dear ones go to the battlefield to get martyred. She watched Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam, Abbas, Ali al-Akbar, Qasim, her children, and other dear ones go to the battlefield. After they were martyred, she went through all those pains. The invasion of the enemy, disrespect, and the responsibility to take care of the surviving children and women. Is it possible to compare the enormity of this tragedy with physical pain? But when she was faced with these difficulties, Zainab al-Kubra did not tell God to save her. She did not say, Oh my Lord, save me, while the shredded body of her brother lay in front of her eyes, tells God, Oh God, accept this sacrifice from us. When she was asked to describe what she had seen, she replied, I did not see anything but beauty. All those tragedies were beautiful to Zainab al-Kubra because they were from and for God, because they were supposed to promote the word of God. The story didn't just end in the afternoon of Ashura. In fact, since the afternoon of Ashura, a movement started in history, which is still growing and expanding. It will be the same in the future too. Imam Hussein alayhi salam did all in his power to proclaim the word of truth and to save the people. These are some of the traits that a person in general can see and show in the Ashura event.
Allah, I want to thank you. Things that you've done.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Japan commemorates the 77th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Survivors and relatives mark the blast anniversary with a minute of silence. The United States dropped the first atomic bomb, codenamed Little Boy, on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, destroying the city and killing 140,000 people, mostly civilians and including many children. A second bomb 3 days later on Nagasaki killed another 70,000 and made Japan surrender and ended World War II. The bombs also left tens of thousands more dead in the months and years that followed, many from radiation-related illnesses. Many who survived the attacks continued to require welfare and medical care. During the memorial, the Japanese Prime Minister said the government would continue to support the survivors and demanded all nations to work together to promote the total abolition of nuclear weapons. It's still a goal far from being realized, but one held as strongly in the two cities that have suffered the most from such weapons. Meanwhile, the U.S., despite being the only country to have used weapons of mass destruction during war, seems to have learned no lesson from the horrific incident.
The weapons should be eliminated from the entire earth. The United States, as a government, as a nation, has learned really no lessons. In fact, although there was a strong movement to eliminate nuclear weapons in the 1970s, resulting in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, in which the United States pledged to eliminate nuclear weapons, it did not do so, and in fact, over the last few years has committed, from the end of the Obama administration, to a $1 trillion nuclear weapons modernization program, which runs directly in the face of any commitment to eliminating nuclear weapons. And so it's really, the United States really has nothing to say about other countries having nuclear weapons until it gets its own act together.
In 1968, the world agreed on a new agreement, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Over 190 countries are currently signed up. Nuclear powers agreed to reduce their arsenals, in exchange others agreed not to have them at all. In the 70s, the deals between Russia and the US continued, more focused on long-range missiles, and though the rivalry between these two global powers intensified in 1991, there was a new START treaty aimed at decreasing the size of their arsenals and underpinning the West's justification for these weapons, which is an idea generally referred to as nuclear deterrence. But now Russia has intensified its rhetoric of using nuclear weapons in the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. The U.S. and the EU, on the other hand, continue to provoke Moscow despite the threats.
Well, there really was no reason for this conflict with Russia other than the way in which it has aided the highly financialized, speculative economy of the United States and, by extension, Germany, France, Great Britain, and Israel, which have committed to a system in which now, because of this massive printing of money and the creation of false assets, only a war economy can save them from this catastrophe. So provoking a war with Russia, a thoughtless and dangerous move, does have the effect of increasing the value of the dollar in the short term.
As tensions rise between these two countries, which still have the largest nuclear arsenals, the world is now forced to look at history and the present to avoid an incident similar to the tragedy of Hiroshima. During the 77th anniversary of the world's first atomic bomb attack, the United Nations Secretary General, while calling for disarmament, said the world is playing with a loaded gun.
And today, the world is in danger of forgetting the lessons forged 77 years ago. almost 13,000 nuclear weapons are being held. Stockpiles are being upgraded. And the common thread of potential nuclear annihilation runs through geopolitical crises the world over, from the Middle East to the Korean Peninsula to Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
A clear example of such threat would be Israel, which has persisted on possessing nuclear weapons. Iran has pushed for the establishment of a Middle East zone free of weapons of mass destruction, which the Islamic Republic initiated at the UN. But Israel won't comply. Tehran has even repeatedly warned that West Asia and the entire world is being threatened by nuclear weapons of the Israeli regime and urged international pressure on Tel Aviv to make it join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Gaza was flashed bright by explosions as Israeli artillery and other weapons targeted what they say were weapons factories and rocket launch sites belonging to the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Following the latest round of aggression initiated by the Israeli military, an aerial duel was also held as rockets were fired from Gaza towards Israel, some intercepted by the Israeli Iron Dome anti-missile system, yet many penetrated deep inside Israel, reaching as far as Tel Aviv. Earlier, in a televised address, the Israeli Prime Minister said the regime had zero tolerance for attacks from Gaza and that isn't interested in a wider conflict in Gaza but will not shy away from one either. Israel has labeled the latest round of aggression as a preemptive operation. It says it aimed to thwart alleged planned rocket attacks by the Islamic Jihad. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad called the initial Israeli bombardment a declaration of war, firing a barrage of at least 100 rockets into southern Israel. Around 13 people were taken to the hospital with minor injuries. Some reports have, however, indicated that many Israelis were killed in the retaliatory attacks. In response to the Israeli aggression, the Al-Quds brigades launched attacks on cities across the occupied territories. Hamas also announced its support for the Islamic Jihad and said it would respond to the strikes. Israel claims it targets military sites, but similar to all other attacks by the regime, civilians seem to be on the receiving end of the rockets.
Definitely, this is a war crime. It's a war crime in itself. The bombing in itself is a war crime. The siege of Gaza and the blockade for 15 years is a war crime. The starving people, cutting off the electricity and cutting off the water supply and cutting off the ability for Palestinians to import much necessary food and building supplies and medicine and allow people to leave and come back is a war crime in itself. This is not acceptable. And that's one thing. The second aspect of it is that the fact that Israel has claimed and actually publicly announced that it is using this as a preemptive in itself is also a war crime because even in international law of war, you are supposed to respond in a proportionate manner if you are being attacked. Actually, even this time, Israel itself admitted that there has been no provocation. Israel has been provoking again and again and again and has been provoking the Palestinians in order to create a war with the Palestinians and in order to punish Palestinians again and again. So Palestinians have not done anything yet. And so Israel went and bombed and killed so many children, so many civilians, has destroyed again Gaza. This is apartheid. This is a crime against humanity.
The United States has time and again vowed to support Israel. This includes the U.S. President's latest trip to Israel, where he pledged full military support for Israel with regard to the Iron Dome, a new laser system, and other military support. And now regarding the latest round of attack against Gaza, the U.S. ambassador to the regime said Israel has a right to defend itself. That is a green light for Israel to continue with its rocket attacks. The U.K. Foreign Secretary also echoed similar remarks, adding that the kingdom stands by Israel.
Biden has continued support for Israel unconditionally. He repeated support for Israel and quote-unquote its security when it is not even threatened. It's the one that's threatening the security of the Palestinian people, including the children, women, elderly people, disabled, everybody. Israel is threatening the security. It's not the other way around. So for the United States to go around and for Joe Biden making so many promises during his campaign against Bush, against Trump, that he was going to roll back many of the aggressive actions of Trump, which were already before Trump, not really happily during Obama as well, and Joe Biden was his vice president, they were actually very problematic against the Palestinians. For Biden not to even reverse the steps, the aggressive steps that Trump has taken against the Palestinians, but to continue military aid, economic aid, collaboration with Israel, justification for Israel's attack on, it is giving a green light, and it is exactly the way we all understood it.
Those statements have, however, drawn criticism from the United Nations. The UN Special Reporter on the Occupied Palestinian Territories slammed the US for the remarks and stated that Israel cannot claim that it is defending itself in this conflict. She also condemned the regime's attacks as illegal and irresponsible. Meanwhile, the office of the Palestinian president called this week's attack a dangerous escalation. The regime's attacks was also followed by a closure of two border crossings with the Gaza Strip. But Palestine has witnessed such acts of aggression from time and again, and the heaviest price is always paid by the civilians. The Gaza Strip has been under an Israeli blockade since 2007. That is 15 years of a blockade. Israel has also waged many wars against the Gaza Strip and killed scores of Palestinians, yet there's no mention of this, while Russia's war in Ukraine takes center stage on a daily basis.
A series of drills across six zones surrounding Chinese Taipei. Conventional missile firepower assault in the waters east of Taiwan. More than 100 warplanes, including fighters and bombers, as well as over 10 destroyers and frigates. These are the largest military drills that China has conducted perhaps ever, showing its awesome military might. This level of force displayed in such a manner shows how angry China is at the U.S. and the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit.
Since 1949,
that Taiwan is an integral part of China. And they see that as China has moved from being under the control of imperialist powers to becoming a strong, independent nation, that they intend to exercise sovereignty over all of their historical, geographical range, including Taiwan.
Ironically, the G7 group of countries and the High Representative of the European Union have now issued a statement condemning these exercises, claiming that they threaten the stability of the region. In this instance, the European side has now backed the U.S. when it comes to its stance against China. Is this another Ukraine conflict scenario playing out? China sees this as a provocation, since it is endorsing and encouraging pro-separatists and pro-independence forces on the island.
Chinese made their strikes, probably using our visit as an excuse. Let me close by saying this. The Chinese have tried to isolate Taiwan. They may try to keep Taiwan from visiting or participating in other places, but they will not isolate Taiwan by preventing us to travel there.
China has in the past viewed Chinese Taipei as part of its territory. It has also publicly stated that it may take it by force one day if necessary. This is where the U.S. and now Europe come in. Just like Ukraine, both are warning China against any thoughts of a takeover, which parallels the conflict in Ukraine.
The People's Liberation Army has now declared 7 restricted zones near Taiwan and say that they will extend a range of military exercises through Monday. These provocative actions are a significant escalation.
I think the issue of provoking China is this. The United States does not have as part of its sort of thinking that somebody is going to be our equal. Now, we have in the Western Pacific this amazing amount of military. Well, China happens to be there. You know, that's part of the world that they're in. And I think that as time goes on, and they have been very clear about this, that they're not prepared to cede American military hegemony to us in the Western Pacific much longer.
But China is not Ukraine, if the military display of China is anything to go by. The U.S. provocations against China and Europe's support come at a dangerous time when the world economy is on the precipice. The U.S. anti-China stance and China's maneuvers are taking place along some of the world's busiest shipping routes. Let's not forget, the global supply of vital semiconductors and electronic equipment produced in East Asia are in this region. Additionally, more than 60% of global maritime trade and more than 22% of the total global trade passes through the South China Sea. Is the U.S. and its European allies willing to risk this?
The war in Ukraine has created massive political and geostrategic shifts in alliances at regional and international levels. The war has now brought back the specter of the Cold War to the global scene. Russia, which is at loggerheads with the United States and its Western allies, says the era of constructive cooperation between Russia and Western countries is irrevocably over. Moscow says the end of the partnership is regardless of the result of the war in Ukraine. Regardless of the duration and outcome of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, we can already state now that the 30-year era of generally constructive, though not problematic, cooperation with the West is irrevocably over.
Well, in politics, nothing is definite and irreversible, as we well know. Certainly, the situation is deeply affected by the events and the stanch positions of either side, particularly the Western and the Russian side. So in the near future, which means in the forthcoming months, is not envisageable a reversal of the distancing that has been signaled by both Russia and the United States and Europe on the issue of Ukraine.
The Russian official added that the current crisis has provided a unique opportunity to get rid of, quote, residual illusions. He also added that Moscow will use the crisis to go beyond the paradigm of what he described as friendly absorption, which Moscow says has been produced over and over again since 1992. It refers to a climate in which dominant powers following the collapse of the Soviet Union promised Russia to accept it as a member of advanced Western developed nations. It's now a fact that the West and its allies are no longer the hegemon powers at the international stage. Following the war in Ukraine, the West imposed a raft of massive and unprecedented sanctions on Russia in a bid to weaken Moscow or to potentially make its economy collapse. The sanctions have hurt Russia's economy, but did not trigger its collapse. On the contrary, Russia's oil and gas revenues have soared over the past few months.
The Western side, with its approach, is also imposing a set of rules which are based on its own interests, although they pretend these rules to be universal. The rest of the world is instead proposing to identify shared rules which may differ in the practice according to the latitude and the cultural experience of the different societies. So this is the existential clash between the two sides.
It's now Western citizens who are paying higher gas and energy prices. The crisis has indeed negatively affected European and North American nations and their economies. It's now widely believed that the U.S. has failed to create a united global front against Russia. The asymmetry of interests and perspectives between Washington and Moscow is unlikely to change anytime soon.
On this, we have to add the fact that the manufacturing capacity of the world has moved from the West to the East, particularly to the Far East, which is Asia. And this weakens considerably the perspectives of the West in long-term confrontation with the rest of the world.
And the latest spat between the United States and China over Taiwan is likely to further strain the relations between the Western-led bloc and the emerging counter-hegemonic alliance. Under these circumstances, emerging powers like Iran, with its vast energy sources and rising military might, can play a pivotal role in the shifting balances between the East and the West.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being. A brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام أعجز الناس من عجز عن اكتساب الإخوان وأعجز منه من ضيع من ظفر به منهم وأعجز منه من ضيع من ظفر به منهم.
Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, "The most helpless of all men is he who cannot find a few brothers during his life, but still more helpless is he who finds such a brother but loses him."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, we are talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. There are so many lessons that we learn from Imam Ali's universal persona, a persona which is a role model for the present day. But interestingly, it has been a role model even for the days of yonder. Imam Ali alayhi salam speaks in a certain place specifically about the dispensation and the meting out of justice by people who are not fit for it. Now, we might think that, giving justice is only something that is done in a court of law. But in reality, in our own various positions in life, we do have certain amount of power and responsibilities as far as meting out and giving justice and the dispensation of justice. So it does apply to each and every one of us in one way or the other. Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that there are two people that are detested by Allah. One is the individual who is devoted to their self. They are a nuisance for those who are enamored of them. Meaning, this individual who is devoted to his self and he makes just judgments upon his whims and desires, they are a problem, a headache for those people who have become in love with them, who hold this kind of unfit individual in high regards. Because not only is that individual themselves misled from the guidance of those preceding them, this individual will mislead those who follow him. So not only are they making up this kind of justice as they go along based upon their whims and their desires and their selfishness, not only are they misleading themselves, not only are they leading to their own destruction, but they are also misleading other people. And Imam Ali says that in their life they are misleading people, and after that individual's death, who mets out justice among the people but are not fit for it, after this individual's death, this person carries the weight of others' people's sins, as well as being entangled in their own misdeeds. So, dear friends, we must be very careful when we are dispensating justice among the people, whether we are a mother or a father, whether we are an older brother, an older cousin, or whether we are, you know, a superior in the workplace, or we are a religious scholar and a student, or we are a student in front of other students, or we are a friend or a colleague or a coworker. In any aspect that we are faced with the dispensation of justice, we must be incredibly careful to be just when we are in the act of the dispensation of justice. Another comprehensive, beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاستجب دعائي واقبل ثنائي و
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master, and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the folly, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
I just would like to share with you one sentiment or the feeling of a lady who was among the followers of Ahlul Bayt. And this is a lady who is known as Sauda bint Ammara bin al-Ashtar al-Hamdaniya. And she was from the family which believed in Amir al-Mu'mineen, from the Hamdaniya Yemeni family and the tribe. And she was a poetess in her own right. She was talented in composing poetry. Very, very powerful words where she says, صَلَّ الْإِلَهَ عَلَى رُوحٍ فَضَمَّنَهُ قَبْرٌ فَعَصْبَحَ فِيهِ الْعَدْلُ مَدْفُونَ. May Allah shower His salawat and blessings on the soul, تَضَمَّنُهُ قَبْرٌ, when the grave took him in, فَعَصْبَحَ فِيهِ الْعَدْلُ مَدْفُونَ. It was not Ali who was buried in there, it was Adl which was buried with him. Means when Ali went, justice is gone. This is what we get from people like you. And so Muawiyah says, what do you know about the justice of Ali? And she says, I'm actually remembering the day where I went to him with a similar complaint like I've come here today. And I went inside, he was doing his nafila prayers. He sensed I was there, he shortened his prayers, turned to me and he said, you know, what is your hajat? Why have you come here? And when I presented the case of his revenue officer, who was being, you know, harsh than required, in his dealing with the issue of, you know, taking revenue for the government, Amir al-Mu'mineen, according to her, he cried at that time on the